When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome back. What if we told you about a major breakthrough on awesome savings on all-inclusive beach vacays?
OMG, this could break the case.
Case? I'm talking about CheapCaribbean.com.
Ooh, is it full of chilling intrigue?
No, it's full of hot savings. CheapCaribbean.com's semi-annual sale is helping you save $200 off your next booking for 4 nights or more. Score site-wide deals to your favorite beaches in Cancun, Aruba, Jamaica, and more now through the end of April.
We gotta take this show on the road.
Let's start at CheapCaribbean.com.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday Savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Don't forget to pack the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies for a post-lunch pick-me-up. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Blood on the Tracks is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis. Bob Dylan was a musical genius and one of the greatest songwriters of all time. He didn't follow leaders. He chased that thin, wild, mercury sound. He never looked back, even as the times changed. And as the times changed, Bob Dylan changed. He tried on and discarded identities like they were masks. He transformed. He transfigured. And somewhere along the way, the Bob Dylan that you thought you knew died. This is his story.
It's the morning of day 3, Sunday, July 31st, 1966. It's been a long night here at my home in Middletown, New York. The patient Robert Zimmerman, a.k.a. Bob Dylan, is still in distress and seems to have had a slight reaction to the painkillers I've given him. His fever-like state continues, although at this stage there are more lucid moments than not. I have put psychological evaluation on hold for the time being. It's my suggestion that we treat his physical injury fully before we explore that. He is also refusing to go home, so he'll remain in my care here in my house for the foreseeable future. That was a decision that was made with the patient's wife, Sarah. We primarily made this choice because, well, to be honest, I'm not entirely sure that at this moment, Bob knows where his home is.
Nashville. That was important to me. Transfiguration, invention, reinvention. Those can all come in different forms, but, you know, sometimes you actually need physical movement. Sometimes you need a change of scenery. If I never went to New York, then I would have never existed. If I'd never gone to Nashville, well, who knows? Creativity is a funny thing. You never know what's going to move the needle or how. I went to that country town for the first time in 1966, and it put my head into a different space. It put my music into a new lane. And now, I can see that it left a whole lot of blood. on the tracks.
Chapter 3. Bob Dylan is a Nashville cat.
I need to get out of here. I need to get out. Outside, Hyde Park goes spinning by, and I feel like I haven't slept in days. I turn to the man next to me and say I wish we could speak English, and he laughs. I thought I'd always record in New York, you know? It was Bob Dylan's hometown. Sure, Bobby Zimmerman was born in Duluth, but Dylan, he was a New Yorker. But you can't just stay on one track your whole life. Remember, life is all about inventing yourself. At some point, I would have to leave New York.
Physical movement.
And it all started on August 4th, 1965. We'd been working on the Highway 61 Revisited album. The song which I'd decided should close the whole thing was called Desolation Row. Another decision we'd come to was that it would be an acoustic song. We'd cut some electric takes, but I don't know. I knew an acoustic one would just be better. So we booked some more studio time, but it didn't, I don't know, it just needed something.
Transfiguration, invention, reinvention.
Bob Johnston, the producer in charge of the session, mentioned that he had asked a guy to come and watch us record. Now, I hadn't been with Johnston for too long at this point, but I trusted him. Turns out I was right to. That guy who came by to watch us called himself Charlie McCoy. Charlie was a Nashville player, a country guy. I knew Charlie's work. I think most people knew his work without even knowing they knew it. He was a killer harp player. Still young, but man, could he play. He did a spot on a song called Harpoon Man. It blew me away. We had a little introduction courtesy of Bob Johnston, and just as he was gonna leave, I figured I'd throw him a curveball.
A new lane.
I told him that we were just about to do a song and wondered if he fancied sitting in. I wanted to see how he'd react. Sure, he said, completely unfazed. I told him to grab the acoustic guitar at the back of the studio and give us some licks. We had finished the take of Desolation Row within the hour. Within the hour.
It put my head into a different space.
We tried to get it in three different sessions before Charlie, but with him, the song just fell into place. He did these flamenco-type fills. It gave the song a real identity.
Nashville.
After he left, Bob Johnston told me that that's what it was like in Nashville. That's how they did it. We released the Highway 61 album later that month. That song with Charlie was the last thing we cut for the record. By the end of the year, I was back in the studio. Man, that year.
Transfiguration.
I started 1965 cutting songs for Bringing It All Back Home, and then we cut Highway 61. Then, before the year was out, we were making Blonde on Blonde.
Invention.
The workload was beginning to show.
Reinvention.
Those first sessions for Blonde on Blonde in New York, they weren't good. I take responsibility. We didn't really have the songs, but the band was the band, you see? I remember one session, we were trying to get the track, She's Your Lover Now. Back then it was called Just a Little Glass of Water. I'd written it about a relationship I'd been in and out of. We spent all day on that song. I mean, all day.
You actually need physical movement.
It started at 2 in the afternoon. Garth Hudson, Rick Danko, Richard Manuel, Robbie Robertson, All those guys I'd relied on before were there, in a setting I knew well, too. Columbia's Studio A in New York City. It should have been easy. But it wasn't like before. We started to cut the track. Bob Johnston asked me what the song was called from the control room, and before I could properly answer, Robbie said, "It's called You Can Have Her." We shared a laugh about that, but there wasn't much more laughter that day. As the minutes of the studio time ticked on, we tried the song a number of ways. By 3 p.m., we'd changed the tempo and the arrangement. By 4, I was at the piano, then the guitar. By 5 p.m., we were no closer than we'd been at 2.
"Do you need a change of scenery?"
I lost my temper with them on one take. I don't know which one. Take 4,000, maybe? I just said to them, "Together. You've just got to play it together." Robbie bit back at me. "We are," he yelled. He moaned that every take was different and they needed time to process it, to process my ideas.
"Creativity is a funny thing."
Well, we didn't have time. Of course every take was different. We were in the studio, which means you're paying for every second. You literally don't have time to waste. Plus, when I'm in the studio, I can't stand too many retakes. Doing the same song again and again sucks the life out of them. You need to capture that magic. We tried again, again it fell apart. I shouted about how ugly the song was. We took a break at 5:30. I smoked and smoked and smoked. 7 p.m., still no good takes. We switched tactics and rehearsed a version we all liked. I remember looking at the big studio clock. 8:47 p.m. We should have had the thing in the can hours ago. Another break. Then 11 p.m. came and went, still working out the damn song. Then midnight. I remember saying, "I can't hear the song anymore. It's gone." And it had.
Who knows?
It was 2 a.m. when the band went home. I was alone with Bob Johnston. He asked me if I wanted to do another take. I said sure.
"Sometimes you need a change of scenery."
So I sat at the piano and mumbled my way through the first verse. But then something clicked. It all fell into place. What it should sound like, how we should structure it. The song's DNA, it just formed in front of me.
"It put my head into a different space."
By the time I'd finished running through it, the song was there. We had our first complete take that I was happy with. Johnston asked from the control room if I should get the guys back to do one last take. No, absolutely not. I realized that very second, the fault was with the band. I pressed the talkback button to the control room and I asked Bob a question. "Hey, what time is the next flight to Nashville?" I thought I was going to be sick. I tried to breathe, but I couldn't get enough air. I put my fingertips over my eyes. What time was it? 6? 7? I couldn't remember where the last 24 hours had gone. The time I spent in Nashville recording from 1966 to 1969 was an important time in my career. I cut some good albums there and also got to work with a hero of mine. I first met Johnny Cash at the Newport Folk Festival on one of my, shall we say, less eventful shows there. I remember after, back in my hotel room, I jumped on the bed shouting, "I've just met Johnny Cash!" I couldn't believe it.
You never know what's gonna move the needle.
By the end of the decade, we were recording together. I was working in Nashville on the Nashville Skyline LP. The city had become my new recording home since the collapse of those blonde-on-blonde New York sessions. It was bearing fruit, too. I was cutting albums that I liked in a way that I liked. Nashville Skyline, like all them Nashville LPs, was quick to make, and it contained tunes that I still stand by today. Lay Lady Lay, for example. That's a big song for me. Norman Blake's steel guitar and Kenny Buttrey's drums are the highlight of that song. I'd wanted some bongos on the tune, so Kenny found me some. I remember him running a cigarette lighter underneath them to tighten the skin.
Invention.
We added some cowbells on top of that, too. Kris Kristofferson, who would win his first Grammy only 2 years later, was working as a studio janitor at the time. Yeah, that's the truth. Kris had to hold the bongos and cowbell next to Kenny's drum kit. He just stood there holding them for all the takes. He should have won a Grammy for that.
Reinvention.
The sessions weren't always a breeze. There were also months of bitter disappointment. Jerry Lee Lewis was recording in Nashville at the same time as us. Bob Johnston took me to see him, knowing I was a big fan. We went into his studio with Johnston being his usual affable self. Meanwhile, Lewis was, well, whatever the opposite of affable is. "This is Bob Dylan," Johnston said. The killer turned to me, shrugged, and said, "So?" I suggested in my most friendly voice that we could do something together in the studio. He just paused and then said, "No." That was it. Two words. So and no.
Nashville.
I would have admired his attitude if I weren't such a fan. But Johnny Cash and I, we had a much better meeting. Johnny was recording in the studio next to us. He came in and saw us cut Nashville Skyline Rag and "Tonight I'll Be Staying Here With You." He was very complimentary. He'd always been supportive. He had recorded a version of my song "It Ain't Me, Babe" a couple years before. It beats mine by a country mile. He was truly the greatest of the greats. We stayed in touch since that first meeting, trading letters and postcards. He defended me when all this acoustic electric nonsense started. He rightfully pointed out that country music was always electric, and no one found issue with that. After that session, we went out for dinner, and the next day decided it was time we recorded with each other. Bob Johnston had produced Johnny's Folsom Prison album the year before, so everybody was comfortable in the studio. We also like to work in the same way while recording, quickly, with little or no overdubs. Johnston had made the studio into a sort of nightclub. The main lights were down low, and he'd set up little lights everywhere. There was a ton of guitars on hand and a couple of microphones for me and Johnny. Before we started, Johnston said to us both, "I can't produce you two. You produce yourselves."
Creativity is a funny thing.
We both laughed, and before we knew it, we'd recorded 18 songs. Johnston wanted us to do another session together for a duets album, which I would have loved, but it never happened. That session with Johnny, though, that remains a defining moment for me, and while for the longest time only one song was released from it. "Girl from the North Country," the opener to Nashville Skyline. It meant everything to me. Johnny was and is the North Star. You could guide your ship by him. It was a big time for him, too. He'd signed a deal with ABC for a new television show, imaginatively titled The Johnny Cash Show. Now, I hated doing TV, really, I did. Hated it. But when John asks you to appear on his show, what are you going to do? Say no? No one says anything but yes to Johnny Cash. So I agreed to be on the first ever episode. I didn't realize it was live. Live.
Nashville.
Usually these things are taped, but this was 100% live. Playing live had become so alien to me, and now I was having to do it in front of the whole country. And I do mean the whole country. People from coast to coast were tuning in to see Johnny and his music, and here they had Bob Dylan doing the thing that they all loved, country music. Man, I had to do it well.
Creativity is a funny thing.
It was at the Ryman Auditorium, a small venue at the best of times, but when you add in a camera crew, stage, set, equipment, and studio audience, well, it's suffocating. Johnny assured me it would be okay, but for the first time in a long time, I was nervous beyond belief.
Who knows?
They asked me to wear a velvet suit for the show. It's TV, they told me. I tried it on and felt even more terrified about the whole thing. I declined their offer. I knew I must have looked nervous because Kenny, the drummer, asked me if I was okay. Shit, man, he said. You look like a frightened kid at a talent show. You know what? Kenny was right, man.
Transfiguration.
John's people led us to the stage and told us we'd be on in 2 minutes after his introduction. I was sweating. It was a mistake, all of it. I was sure of it.
It put my head into a different space.
Why was I even doing this? Why was I here? I hadn't rehearsed properly. If you run a marathon without training, you'd crash out after the first mile. Why did I think this would be any different? Johnny was on the other side of the auditorium, and he nodded to me as the lights went out. They had the band in darkness. I mean, complete darkness. They might as well have not been there. No one could even see them. It was just me in the spotlight, like I was Etta James or something. At last. I was never comfortable with that pop star shit, especially not at this moment in my life.
That was important to me.
Someone started counting down from 5 to 4. I thought to myself, what if I ran? Just ran out that door now. And then I cursed myself for picking a new song.
Reinvention.
I couldn't have picked something I'd played 1,000 times before on 1,000 stages, no. But before I could even finish that thought, I heard 3, 2, 1. And then a huge red light illuminated everything, followed by a spotlight. Johnny, in his trademark drawl, said, "Ladies and gentlemen, here is Bob Dylan." And I felt my stomach drop 15 stories. I played, I threw it all away. And somehow I didn't throw it all away.
You never know what's gonna move the needle or how.
Even though the song's runtime is only 2.5 minutes, it felt like it went at a glacial pace. Later, I sang with Johnny live on air, which was even more exhilarating than in the studio. But the whole thing reminded me. I wasn't the man I was before. Something had changed. Maybe forever. I didn't know it that night, but the Johnny Cash show would be my last fond memory in Nashville. Music City would soon turn sour, and I'd once again have to pack my bags and find a new creative home.
We'll be right back after this
word.
With the best all-inclusive vacation deals to Mexico and the Caribbean, booking your getaway with Cheap Caribbean Vacations means you have more freedom to do your deal. Whether you want to enjoy snorkeling, endless margaritas and more, or simply soak up the sun and sand in a tropical paradise, Cheap Caribbean Vacations has your deal for that. Plan and book the exact getaway you want at exactly the right price for you by using our exclusive budget beach finder, or find a featured all-inclusive package to Generations Riviera Maya Resort and do your deal at cheapcaribbean.com.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, "We are going to give women meaningful beauty." And I said, "That's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life."
Meaningful Beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light. Catch all 7 rounds, 3 days, live from Detroit, April 25th to 27th with NFL Network draft coverage presented by Verizon, and on ABC, ESPN, ESPN Deportes, and streaming on NFL Plus. It all starts Thursday, April 25th at 8 p.m. Eastern. Visit NFL.com/draft for more information. Presented by Verizon, the official 5G network of the NFL.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
My cigarette was burning to the bitter end. I took one last drag and tried to get my vision in focus. I turned to the person next to me and saw the most famous man in the world, and he looked angry. Nashville saved Blonde on Blonde, no doubt about it. Me, though, I was pretty beat up at that point. The pace I was living at during that time wasn't livable without drugs. The rate I was going always meant I was going to crash. The pills, they could prolong that speed, well, for a little while at least.
Sometimes you actually need physical movement.
When we were recording Blonde on Blonde in Nashville, I was still writing the songs. Some days I'd make the session players, Charlie McCoy, Wayne Moss, Pig Robbins, all those Nashville cats. I'd make them hang around in the studio till I'd finished the songs. Some nights they'd wait until 2 or 3 in the morning, and I'd saunter in and say, "Okay, we're ready."
Creativity is a funny thing.
At first I think they enjoyed it, but after a while boredom set in. They played cards and even invented a game where they'd throw quarters into the ceiling tiles. You could get them lodged in there if you threw them just right. This pressure for creativity meant that I had to have a stimulant to keep me going. And it worked, just about. We got the album done, didn't we? Even if the final session literally lasted all night until the dawn. Those cats, man, they could play.
Nashville.
They got the songs. They helped get down on tape what was in my head.
Sometimes you need a change of scenery.
There was one evening that stayed with me, though. After a rehearsal of the song Rainy Day Women, I asked the guys in the band what they did here. You know, when they weren't busy making records. They weren't used to artists asking them that. I could tell. The song talks about getting stoned. So is it about drugs? Make up your own damn mind. Use your own ears. I'm not here to discuss that. But for the song to work, to have the atmosphere that I wanted it to have, I needed everyone in the studio to be in the right frame of mind.
It put my head into a different space.
I couldn't make this song with everyone straight, so we came up with a plan. We sent one of the studio custodians out to a bar. Now, Nashville cats never drank in the studio, ever. So this was quite new to them, and they took to it instantly. There was one slight problem, however. I'd sent out for a drink I'd seen somewhere, leprechaun cocktail. You heard of him? No, me neither. Well, not before Nashville, anyway. They're supposed to come in a shot glass, a miniature yet highly toxic concoction. But the custodian, he came back with all these drinks in milkshake cartons. They were gigantic.
Transfiguration.
We drank them down, of course. They were like razors on your throat. And that feeling only got wilder when we passed round joints, too. The atmosphere was finally taking shape.
That was important to me.
Later, someone had the idea of putting a trombone on the song, and so we called up a friend of one of the cats, Wayne Butler. Woke him up in the middle of the night. He got dressed, grabbed his trombone, came to the studio, took a quick swig from the milkshake carton, played his part, and then went right back to bed. That was it.
Nashville.
I wanted them all to sound like a Salvation Army band that had been defiled, and let me tell you, they delivered. That's what it was like in those sessions. But that's not what it was always like with drugs. Later that year, I was in London. Man, London had become a drag. This was on that Judas tour, you recall. I'm still struggling to escape from that damn tour. I'll be struggling to escape it for the rest of my life. Mark my words.
Who knows?
I'd been up all night with John Lennon at his house in the suburbs. We decided to get his driver to take us into London to have a look around the place. It all seemed so pretty in that spring morning light, but somewhere between the Ritz and Hyde Park, the hangover and the come down kicked in. The whole thing was filmed for that ABC documentary, the one I was supposed to be working on in Woodstock. Look, the footage is awful. There you have two of the biggest musicians in the world, not solving any problems, not writing any songs, just blabbing on, talking shit. It wasn't just the drugs, though. John and I were too tense around each other. I can never exactly say why. We were similar, in a way, I guess. Too similar. We would never have made it work in the studio together.
Creativity is a funny thing.
Now, George Harrison? He was a good writing partner. I always got on with George. We wrote and spent time together. We ended up becoming good friends. Hell, we'd even end up in a band together. But John was different. He'd tell me years later about how uptight he was in the car that day, and not just because of the junk we were on. I don't know. I was embarrassed about it all. Being out of control, burnt out. I didn't want him to see me like that.
That was important to me.
I was a mess, you know. You can't hide it when you're a mess. The veil had slipped, and I didn't have the energy to pick it back up. As the car journey wore on, I knew I was going to be sick. I remember saying I was going to be sick, right into the camera. I'd done and said everything else straight into that fucking camera on that tour, so why not be sick in front of it? They'd love that, the Judas crowd.
New Lane.
That would finish off their story, the final miserable act of their former folk hero. I was sweating and I couldn't see straight. My mouth tasted of cigarettes and snot. Even the pale morning light gave me a headache through my shades. I said to John, "Look, I don't want to be sick in here, but I'm going to be sick." He made some quip about a remedy for sore eyes, groovy forehead, or curly hair. I couldn't even respond.
Sometimes you need a change of scenery.
Later, when he dropped me off at the Mayfair Hotel, I made good on my promise and spilled my guts everywhere. I thought back to Nashville while in that hotel, sobering up. I thought about how fun drugs used to be. That crazy night while still recording Rainy Day Women, and the morning after too. Those quarters still dangling from the ceiling tiles as I was finishing off some lyrics. The cats were in the next room on a break playing with a Ouija board. I'm not even joking. They were having to find new ways of keeping boredom at bay between takes. The bass player, this guy named Henry Strzelecki, he said, "You know, this is going to be the biggest album in the world or it ain't gonna do nothing." Then I grabbed the lyric sheet to "I Want You" and told them I was ready to go again.
July 15th, 1965, New York City. Tom Wilson stood in the middle of Columbia Records Studio A and narrowed his eyes at Bob Dylan. His scrunched-up eyes did the talking for him. What the fuck, man? Tom Wilson was the producer, not Bob Dylan. Dylan didn't know what the hell he was talking about. He was way out of his league. He wanted Wilson to actually turn the organ up in the song's mix. Wilson shook his head. "That cat's not even an organ player, man." Dylan jumped out of his seat and moved the goddamn fader himself. He looked Wilson in the eyes. "Don't ever tell me who's an organ player and who's not." Tom Wilson kinda had a point. The guy on organ, Al Cooper, wasn't actually an organ player, or a piano player for that matter. He was laboriously working out the song's chords and sequence on the Hammond B2 keyboard, which he did by waiting for the rest of the band to play a chord before he would join in behind them. It resulted in a delayed organ riff that, to Tom Wilson, sounded like a child's third lesson, but to Bob Dylan, sounded just right. When Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone was released as a single in the summer of 1965, it shattered the earth. And that argued over organ riff was left up high in the mix, just where Bob Dylan had put it. Bob Dylan's journey to Nashville was a long time coming, and it actually started before the fateful Newport Folk Festival. Up until the recording of Like a Rolling Stone, Dylan had made most of his records with producer Tom Wilson. But for both the producer and the artist, the sessions for Like a Rolling Stone would prove to be the last straw. The relationship soured when Wilson named Dylan's fourth album another side of Bob Dylan. Dylan wasn't overly impressed with it. He was less impressed when, just the year before, Wilson had booked a session without Dylan's knowledge in order to add some overdubs to his recordings. While Wilson was a godfather of folk music, Dylan decided he'd had enough. He needed a facilitator in the producer's chair, not a babysitter. And since Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman, also had a frayed relationship with the producer, the decision was an easy one. Wilson was out. After the Newport Folk Festival, Bob Johnston was in the control room. He'd received the call from Columbia Records a few weeks before. Ever the Southern gentleman, he actually called Wilson to explain the situation, to which Wilson replied, "Hell, I knew they were going to fire me." Bob Johnston, on the other hand, he'd long admired Dylan and had even explicitly expressed his desire to work with him. And now he could go into the forthcoming sessions with a clear conscience. In those early Highway 61 sessions, while in the presence of Grossman and Columbia Records Vice Chairman Bill Gallagher, Johnston suggested Dylan might one day want to record in Nashville. And Dylan brushed off the suggestion as he did, and Johnston couldn't help but notice Gallagher and Grossman exchange glances. A week later, Johnston sat outside Gallagher's office at the Columbia Records building. He tried to comb his messy hair with his fingers, and he buttoned up his shirt. He attempted to calm his nerves. He tried, but could not imagine any scenario where the record producer being summoned to the vice chairman's office was a good thing. And Columbia Records vice chairman Bill Gallagher's secretary appeared, and he was ready. Johnston walked inside Gallagher's office, and after Grossman sat next to the vice chairman's large wooden desk, Grossman dwarfed the damn thing. His huge physical presence was matched only by the presence of his character. Grossman didn't say hello. In fact, he didn't say anything until, after 5 minutes of forced conversation between the other two men, he addressed Bob Johnston directly. "If you ever mention Nashville to Dylan again, we will fire you." The words were half spoken and half spat. Gallagher attempted to soften the delivery. "What Albert is trying to say is we're having too much success the way things are at the moment." Gallagher and Grossman outlined in no uncertain terms that Bob Dylan was the quintessential New York hipster, and after everything that had happened with his career, image, the music over the last few months, Nashville would be a change that Columbia was not willing to accommodate. So instead, Johnston brought Nashville to Bob Dylan. The next month, he called Charlie McCoy into the Desolation Row session, and Nashville immediately became an inevitability. Once Dylan had seen what Nashville could offer in the form of McCoy's stunning guitar work, it rendered both Gallagher and Grossman powerless. And if they wanted to argue, they would be the ones who would be fired. And they'd wind up wherever it was Tom Wilson had crawled off to. Bob Dylan's time in the capital of capital C country was time well spent. And not only did it deliver one of his greatest albums in the form of Blonde on Blonde, but it also brought him back into the studio after his 1966 motorcycle crash. Once installed in the city fully, he recorded his next three LPs there.
two of those albums, 1967's John Wesley Harding and 1969's Nashville Skyline, were commercial and critical hits, confirming Dylan's artistic status. Debilitating motorcycle accident be damned. And simply by making those records, he changed Nashville forever. After it was revealed that he cut his magnum opus and one of rock's first and finest double albums in the city, the floodgates opened. Nashville became not just a center for country music, but a center for music. Partly due to the fact that Dylan had included the names of the album's musicians, those Nashville cats, across the LP's gatefold. However, by the turn of the decade, the magic and refuge Nashville had given Dylan was starting to wear off. And for the 1970 album New Morning, he returned to New York. He wouldn't cut another studio album in Nashville. His time in Nashville also coincided with the end of the 60s, a decade where Dylan had been both a poster boy for a generation and its saboteur. His celebrity had swelled and burst. He'd gone on a supersonic pace and then slowed to a crawl. It was a decade of change and reinvention for both him and for the world, and in many ways, the fate of both were intertwined. The next decade, the 1970s, would bring even more change. The ride would be rougher, fate's simple twist not so simple, and there would be plenty of blood on the tracks. Blood on the Tracks is produced by Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. It's hosted and executive produced by me, Jake Brennan. Also executive produced by Brady Sadler. Zeth Lundy is lead editor and producer. This episode was written by Ben Burrow. Story and copy editing by Pat Healy. Mixing and sound design by Colin Fleming. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker. This episode featured Chris Anzalone as Bob Dylan. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the Blood on the Tracks series page. Follow Double Elvis on Instagram at Double Elvis and on Twitch at Disgraceland Talks. And you can talk to me, per usual, on Instagram and Twitter at Disgraceland Pod. Rock and roll.
Welcome back. What if we told you about a major breakthrough on awesome savings on all-inclusive beach vacays?
OMG, this could break the case.
Case? I'm talking about CheapCaribbean.com.
Ooh, is it full of chilling intrigue?
No, it's full of hot savings. CheapCaribbean.com's semi-annual sale is helping you save $200 off your next booking for 4 nights or more. Score site-wide deals to your favorite beaches in Cancun, Aruba, Jamaica, and more now through the end of April.
We gotta take this show on the road.
Let's start at CheapCaribbean.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Lisa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit lisa.com/iHeart. That's LEESA.com/iHeart.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light. Catch all 7 rounds, 3 days, live from Detroit, April 25th to 27th, with NFL Network Draft coverage presented by Verizon and on ABC, ESPN, ESPN Deportes, and streaming on NFL Plus. It all starts Thursday, April 25th at 8 p.m. Eastern. Visit NFL.com/draft for more information. Lowe's knows home improvement. Lowe's, official sponsor for the 2024 NFL Draft.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.